Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review, featuring interviews with authors of fiction with engaging stories and nonfiction that addresses some of the most critical issues of our past, present, and future. I'm your host, Hopeton Hay. On today's show, contributor Amanda Moore interviews Cheryl Head, author of the mystery novel Time's Undoing.
Today, I'm very excited to speak with Cheryl Head. Cheryl Head writes the award-winning Charlie Mack Motown Mysteries, whose female PI protagonist is queer and Black. Cheryl is an Anthony nominee, two-time Lambda Literary Award finalist, a three-time Next Generation Indie Book Award finalist, Independent Publishing Book Award Silver Medalist, and winner of the Golden Crown Literary Society's Popular Choice Award. Cheryl's books are included in the Detroit Public Library's African American Book List and the Special Collections of the State of Michigan Library. She is vice chair of the BoucherCon Board of Directors. Her newest book, which we will be discussing today, is called Time's Undoing. It is an historical crime fiction novel based on her family's personal tragedy and published by Dutton Books. Time's Undoing was an Indie Next Picked and Amazon Best Book of March 2023. Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you so much, Amanda. Very happy to be here.
Can you tell us about your book for those of our listeners who have not had a chance to read it yet?
Absolutely. So Time's Undoing is a book set in two timelines. 1929 is a contemporary story, and 2019 is a historical fiction piece. This is crime fiction, actually, but it has a lot of other kinds of elements, romance and some suspense. And, you know, there's a lot going on in this book. It's kind of hard to categorize it, I found. It is a story that's based loosely on a tragedy in my own family. In 1929, my grandfather was killed by Birmingham, Alabama police. My family knew very little about the details of that murder. My mother held on to it for years and told my siblings and I about it over the generations and over the decades. My grandmother did as well. But it was always a mystery in our family. I'd often thought about writing the book about his death, but I didn't know how to do it without having some facts to gird the story. But when George Floyd was killed in March 2020, I thought this is the time to write this story. So I set off on the idea of writing it as crime fiction. The contemporary story has a young protagonist named Megan McKenzie, who's a journalist. In the story, it is her great-great-grandfather who has been killed by Birmingham, Alabama police. She works for the Detroit Free Press as a Black Lives Matter beat reporter. And she convinces her editorial team to let her go to Birmingham and suss out the clues to solve that murder, but also to make a connection to contemporary readers that excessive force cases involving police and Black community is not a new phenomenon. So she sets off to do that work in Birmingham. While she's there, she meets new friends and gets some help from a supportive community, and also puts her life in danger as she begins to uncover some deeply held secrets there in Birmingham. So it was a labor of love. Glad to write it. It was a different departure from writing my series.
Well, and what I could appreciate is not just the storyline, but the technical side. Like, you saw what a journalist has to do to make sure they get the story right. Yeah. Did you intend to convey that you have to get in there and look at the thing, spend the time in the places you need to spend the time to make sure that the story is right, correct, and everything is portrayed in an accurate way?
I certainly did intend that. You know, I don't know how much, riveting reading that makes, but I wanted to show that her tenacity and her kind of daunting spirit to just get into the details of it. And, you know, being a reporter, especially an investigative reporter, is not a lot of fun work. I worked as a reporter in Detroit. I'm not a journalist, but I was both a street reporter for radio and TV there. And there are lots of dull parts of the job, you know, but if you want to do it right, and Megan, who has a J school degree, wants to get it right, I wanted to show her process. She's a young woman, but I want to show her seriousness and her professionalism in getting this work right. And so we spend time with her going through the archives of newspapers, you know, hours on end, you know, making the phone calls to potential witnesses, to people who can give her information. And so some readers like that. Other people go like, why am I reading this stuff about you? But others get it.
Well, I like it. I like it that you brought it into the story in a very seamless way, because on one hand, we're seeing what she's looking up. She has a personal interest in this, but she also has the objective style of her training. So it does come across well.
Good. She's trying very hard to walk that tight walk of being professional at the same time being emotional about the story.
So one of the first things that readers will see in your book, and you had mentioned it before, is the rotating perspective between the late 1920s and 2019. And you just explained why you chose those two. And I noticed that one perspective for readers is from the great-grandfather. And the other's perspective is by the great granddaughter. And you did them in first person.
Yes.
So was that something that you planned to do? Was it something that you kind of wanted readers to experience kind of through the eyes of your characters?
Yes, I certainly wanted to do that. It kind of happened by accident because I started writing the 1929 sections first. And I thought those needed to be in the grandfather's voice. And from his perspective, I realized I was doing first person. And I had vowed never to write first person again after writing my first book, because it's hard, you know. But I thought it was the best way to get into their heads, you know. And for the grandfather, you must be in his head in this story throughout the journey of the book. So when I got to Megan's story, I thought, well, yeah, I got to stay in first person. And turns out I grew to really like her. I didn't have a clue about this young woman when I started. But I really grew to like her as a person, you know. I was dead set on presenting the grandfather in as complex and rich and full descriptions I could, because I didn't want to paint him as just some saint, you know, which can happen when you're writing about your family. So I felt I was in some ways like Megan, trying to straddle the line between making the characters, you know, full and robust and balanced, and not turning it into some kind of glorified view of my grandfather.
Well, and I noticed that when you rotated between the lives, the life of the great-grandfather and the daughter, they had things in common.
Yes.
And experiences they had. How important was it for you to show the similarities of their lives and the differences?
Yes. So much of this happens organically, Amanda. It's amazing to me. I mean, I thought, because I discovered that as I was doing the edit, I'm going like, wow, they got a lot in common here. And I think it's because I was sequencing the book and going between the straddling back and forth between the two eras that I wanted to, for the reader, to see the to have organically feel these commonalities as they were going through the story. So it wouldn't feel abrupt when I was shifting gears these two centuries. So they're both 28, for instance. You know, so when I was thinking about this morning, some people have said that they thought that it felt like a YA book sometimes. And I thought, well, you know, everybody important in this book is a young person under 30. Megan and Darius and all Kristen is under, you know, they're under 30. My grandfather was 28 when he died, you know, and his wife was 9 years younger, Anna Cates, you know, so she's still in her teens. So, I wanted those similarities to be there. I'm glad you picked up on it. I didn't want it to be like, you know, so obvious, but I wanted people to feel it as they went through the two sections, the historical section and the contemporary section.
And I'm sure that this happens when you are looking at modern day in history. There are certain sections that resonate with you. And I found myself really liking the scenes from the 1920s. And maybe it was because there's so much that has changed, but so much that has stayed the same. But you describe everyday life And it was very visual. I could see all this in my head as I'm reading it. And so how much research did you do to ensure the accurate descriptions of the time period? I mean, you describe his car, you describe the boarding house and the people that he lives with, how they got to work every day, what they did on the weekends. Like, how did you research that information in order to make sure it came through your story?
Yeah, I did. I did a lot of research on 1929. I didn't know a lot about that year. I not only did research about Birmingham in 1929, but the country as a whole. I wanted to really get a sense of the zeitgeist of the country then. And the most valuable resource for me in doing that work, Amanda, were Black newspapers. To capture the culture and the feel and the day-to-day activities of folks who were living in a segregated community. I wanted it not to be a book just about misery and death and sadness. Mm-hmm. I wanted it to also be about Black joy and Black love. And so I wanted to paint those sections, which I wrote very organically. Those were the easiest sections for me to write. You know, I got out of my head, took the research I had done and just kind of wrote with a lot of flow I did. Those newspapers, you know, they talked about society news. I was looking at the sports sections. There were two or three really robust newspapers in 1929, owned and operated by Black folks. And they were just a rich resource for the daily life of, in this case, Robert and Anna Kate. They talked about transportation, you know, how you buy your groceries. People were offering piano lessons, lots of ads for funeral homes, because everything was segregated. And so Black folks had a whole separate kind of parallel life to white folks in Birmingham in 1929. And so therefore, I wanted to paint that as a place where people not only felt the pressure of prejudice and segregation and the draconian laws of Jim Crow, but also were thriving within their communities, even as they face this horrible segregation.
And you also talk about the way you describe the great-grandfather. And do we call him Lee or Robert? Because I know it goes both.
It's Robert, Robert Lee. But yes, you'll see that.
Okay. Robert.
Too much.
Yes. I love how you really describe the perspective of a family man. That yeah. He wants to have a job, support his family. And once he makes sure that's okay, then he brings his family in. How important was it for you to share that with the readers, that not just a Black man, but a Black family man who had others to look after as well?
That's right. I wanted to put every little snippet of information I knew about my grandfather in this book. And one of the things my mom and my grandmother said all the time is how protective he was of his family and how interested he was in family. And I think that was the case for a lot of folks in 1929, because they had to rely on each other so much. So I wanted to show him as a complex man, as I said before, a person who really loved his wife and loved his children. Great pride in his material things. I had heard that about him growing up, that he had a new car every year. Dressed sort of like a dandy. So I wanted that to be part of his characteristic in this book. Also very proud of his occupation as a carpenter. So you will see scenes there where he's really inculcating his mastery of carpentry and how important that is to him. And that was kind of a through line, even as some of the descriptions in 1929. It was important for me to show not only his love of his family and his connection to family, but his love of community and the relationships he had in the extended family that he built at the boarding house.
And I was actually, you read my mind. I was going to ask you about carpentry, because you highlight he's very skilled, very respected for his skills. And was that something that you wanted to highlight, that was his profession, but not just his profession, he was good at it.
He was good at it. Yeah, he was a master carpenter. Had left St. Petersburg to work temporarily in Birmingham, because that was a time when Birmingham was considered the Pittsburgh of the South, is how they marketed themselves. They were having a steel boom. And so some of these very rich steel barons were building mansions that required great carpentry skills. And so I wanted to paint that as kind of his place where he felt kind of the most pride as a Black man, you know, one that set him apart from other men, Black or white. And so that's why the carpentry references are there, and his connection to carpentry is there throughout.
So which character in the book did you most enjoy writing
about? Oh, that's a good question. I think it's Robert. Why it's Robert? Because I didn't know my grandfather. You know, he was dead all the time I've been alive. So I really felt he helped me write the book. I felt that this book gave me a spiritual connection to him that I had never had before. And so there were times when I would just get frustrated with having gone through, 25 hours of looking through newspaper articles and not finding a thing that helped me, as I was kind of trying to find out what I could say about him. Because at the same time, I'm doing research on his death, which I've never done before. And so I felt nudged sometimes, like this little, go there, look up this kind of thing. And so I felt I got to know him in a way that I would never have if I hadn't written his story. I was talking to my mother about it, who's still alive. She's 95. And, she was only 2 when her grandfather was dead. And she said, "I'm sure your grandfather's helping you write this story. I just know he is. He would do that." I said, "Okay, Mom." Yeah, so I really grew to like him as a person. And I even though I painted him with flaws, as you can see in the book.
So let's talk about the genre of this book. Okay, so it's referred to as a historical crime fiction, but it's based on your own family's personal history and the tragedy and everything that came with that. So how would you want this book to be categorized?
When I wrote it, I thought it was like family saga is what I thought in my head as I was writing it. And then, of course, when you start talking to the publisher, they're trying to fit it in a box, I was told at the beginning that the best way to do this is to steep it in crime fiction. So we shifted some chapters around to make sure that people were understanding this was one fiction and then crime fiction. So I get that. But then the historical fiction elements are so rich and resonate so much with people. It has been, categorized as historical fiction. I think it's a book that kind of defies its tags. It's kind of a place to be. There's a romance in there, I was trying to figure out if it's women's fiction and would men read it, but then the first couple chapters are really strong male characters in activity. I probably shot myself in the foot not writing something that was easily categorized as a certain kind of genre, but I felt the story had all this complexity and I wanted to put all of it in there.
And I think he did that, because there are parts that I pulled from one category, the romance, and his relationship with Anna Kate is very interesting. She's like a quiet force in her own right. And so that actually had, I'm sure many readers were like, that reminds me of my great grandmother, that quiet force, right? Yeah. The strongest voice in the room is not always speaking.
Absolutely.
And so I did like that. Regarding, now you do the historical side, a lot of this takes place in Birmingham.
Yes.
And Birmingham has although the church bombing happened after the 1920s, but before 2019, you still bring that in as far as like the historical part of what the main character is dealing with.
That's right.
When she's digging around for facts.
Absolutely.
Is that something that you've heard about, or you imagine it'll be hard for someone going back into a world and digging up things that people don't want to come to light?
Right.
Was that something that you wanted to bring out in the story, or is that just kind of a side effect of digging in the past for that character?
Yeah, I wanted that to come out in the story. I think we're very easily driven to forget things that happened in the past or let them go. And I don't think we should do that, because I think it tells us so much about where we are now. So, there's a scene early in the book where her parents are arguing about this, the merits of going back to Birmingham. Her father's born and raised there, so he has an affinity for the South. The mom is a Northerner filled with these stories she's heard about Birmingham and its terrible legacy during the civil rights era. And so she's kind of straddling that as she goes back as well. But there's a, I don't know if you remember this, Amanda, there's a scene where she goes back to the place where the boarding house was. Mm-hmm. It's no longer there, you know, 90 years later. But she's standing there and she remembers this quote from her father, a friend of her father, who says, "The earth holds all the dirt." So yes. She's just standing there and trying to, you know, feel the feels that seep up through the ground about how Birmingham might have been in the 20s. And then remembering the legacy of Birmingham in the civil rights era as this place where these draconian laws ruled over Black people for so many years, even as the city wants to reframe itself and be seen differently. You know, I don't think places get rid of that legacy so easily, not like people. You know, that's in your marrow, you know?
Yes.
So I wanted to make the point that even though we try to forget history, or we shun history, or we want to ban books that have historical references, that stuff is not going away, because memory has a spiritual levitation that stays with us no matter what we want to do. It's in our bones, it's in our marrow, it's in the earth. So we might as well face it, look at it, and learn from what we can find about people and places so that we can get to a better place.
Absolutely. And that actually segues perfectly into my next question for you. You have a great quote in the book, and I'm going to read it to you because you have to hear it.
Okay.
You write that sometimes family secrets are best kept until all those with even a sliver of memory are gone, when there is no more blame to assign or guilt to claim. But pain doesn't dim with memory. It resides deep in the marrow and lasts for a generation. Mm-hmm. Did you find it hard as a writer to tell this story in this way, pulling from those experiences and that research? Did you find it hard to convey that on a page, or what was your experience with that?
I found it hard in the process of writing it. You know, I really did. But it turned out to be terribly painful, but also mightily cathartic. I was able, in doing the research, which I did, you know, I didn't know, start off thinking I was going to do research, but I was just, you know, organically writing the story. But then I realized, you know, really to write about my grandfather, I need to see what I can find out more about my grandfather. So I started doing really systematic oral histories with my mother on the phone, sometimes video. No one else in her family is really around. So then I thought, let me see what I can find in newspapers. So I was Googling Robert Harrington's name. And so that was when I was spending those hours and hours in the newspapers. I came across, I found the newspaper article that's there for Megan, who shows it to her team saying, "This is what I know about my grandfather." That's the actual copy of the article that I found while I was researching this story. And it was the first bit of proof that we had that my mother's retelling, my mother's memory, my grandmother's memory of this was actually true. So I remember finding it. I was writing at my dining room table that day, looking through newspapers after Googling Robert Harrington, and there are a whole lot of Robert Harringtons in the United States of America, even in 1929, coming across that article, calling my mother, crying first, and then calling my mother to share it. And because we had that newspaper article, we had the actual date of his death, which we never knew.
Wow.
And because I had that, I was able to get his death certificate, which gave me even more information about the circumstances of his death, like the wounds that he suffered, the actual address of his death and the time of day and all that stuff. So it was, you know, there were times when it was very painful. There were times when it felt very lighthearted to me. You know, when I was writing about Darius and Megan's love story, that felt like fun. There were times I'd laugh aloud at the interactions between Robert and Anna Kate, you know. So it wasn't always heavy, but it was mostly always emotional.
Okay. And you draw comparisons between the Black Lives Matter movement, right? You even have a leader of the movement, the local area in there, and the hostile lifestyle that Black Americans experienced during the South. Were you wanting to draw a connection between the life of Black men or Black people then and now? Was that something you were trying to do as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted all the sections, all the themes in every section to have that through line from the historical to contemporary. I do think the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, brought to our consciousness this this chronic condition of excessive force by law enforcement against Black people and Black communities. I wanted that to be front and center. I also wanted to, that's why the Klan shows up, you know, in 1929, you know, not too far from wearing the hoods, but they're also in the contemporary sections now without hoods, maybe wearing baseball caps this time, but still a ubiquitous and threatening force against, you know, the civility of this country and against democracy itself, in my opinion. So I wanted to paint those through lines that, you know, if we're not diligent, we can repeat all this crazy stuff we've been through. We can have all this divisiveness repeat itself. It's already there, you know?
Yeah.
That's why we really have to, you know, kind of, I think we have to call out people now rather than ignore any of this stuff. I really, you know, book banning, critical race theory, all this abridgment of rights that we're seeing in states, we have to call this out as not something that we want to repeat.
And did you, who did you feel was your strongest character?
Okay, I had fun writing Monique.
Monique, okay, yes. I could tell you had fun writing
her. I don't know. Monique.
That was great. You know, we all need a Monique in our lives.
We need a Monique, and she's an amalgam of, you know, strong women I've dealt with. And, you know, Monique was ready always to throw down. So, I liked her.
Okay. And did you have plans for a character? And then as you wrote, it went into a different direction.
Yeah, I didn't know where Kristen was going. I knew Kristen, I wanted to paint at least one person who becomes an ally and kind of a true ally, one who gives more than lip service to it. You know, lots of folks say, I want to be your ally in this. But when the rubber meets the road, we'll back away from it. And I wanted Kristen to not be that kind of person. I felt like I left her in the lurch in this book. I'm thinking about a sequel where I tie some things together for her. And so I didn't really know what kind of character she would be. I didn't know, it's interesting, I'm thinking as you ask this great question. So she's one of the white characters, not, you know, plays an okay role, but I didn't want to have white saviors in the book.
Yeah.
The other person I really didn't know where he was going is Jim Saxby. He's the other white character who shows up. I wanted him to be there to be, you know, a support to Megan, especially in helping her to get to Birmingham and stay there because of the economics of the newspaper business. But there were times when I gave Monique a role where he might have been, or I started off giving him the role and then backed away and gave it to Monique. I was conscious of that.
And just a suggestion, I think that you may need to have some recipes to go with the book club because your character loves to cook. And not only they love to cook, I think even Anna Kate has a meal in there too.
Yes,
and I feel like that was a really great element to add in. So what were you thinking, your process in adding in the community of sharing cooking with family and friends?
Oh, thank you for getting that and liking it. I had two motives. One, in all my books, I've got food and cooking because I think food is one of those things that in any setting, you can pull people together, disparate people together and come to some decisions, you know, so that's always going to be an element. But in this particular book, I wanted to give Megan, since I knew I was going to present her as this kind of overzealous, very serious young Black woman doing journalism work, I wanted to give her a softer side, another side, a creative side. And so she's a good cook. She finds satisfaction in whipping up bread and baking and all that stuff. And I thought it was just fun to present her that way, so we see a different side of her. And it connected her then to her newfound friends in Birmingham to be making dinner for them and that kind of thing. Again, some readers thought, why am I reading about food? You know, but I think it's because when it's described as crime fiction, you're expecting the tropes of crime fiction, and that's not necessarily one of them. And I'm always going to have food in my books, always.
And were there any subjects when you were completing your manuscript, were there any subjects that you wanted to further explore? And you may have gone down that path or you may not. I mean, is there anything that you want to expand upon?
Yeah. I didn't, towards the end, we were writing more about the conspiracies that exist now around white supremacy. I had written about that in my last Charlie Mack book. And so I hadn't really intended to put in this book at all, but it turned out to be a pretty interesting and useful device for me to again, have the parallel between the two eras. And so I think I wrote enough about it. I didn't want to write any more about it. I wrote about it in the Charlie Mack series because I think it's very important for us to be diligent and to understand that this kind of movement is happening now in plain sight, you know, that these people look just like our neighbors and our postmen and, you know, the people we see every day. So I'm always going to be, as a crime fiction writer, I always feel like I'm looking on the horizon and giving warnings. So yes, I wanted that to be there, but I think I gave it enough room in this book.
So I love how it goes back and forth. And then it's like a snapshot of a young woman wants to find out what happened in her family. And she gets, you know, she goes on that journey to get that information. With so many stories that you've written and so many plot lines that you've created, how did you know you were done with this particular story?
I wanted to close the loop on Robert's story. So I knew when I got Robert in this fictional journey to a place where he could let go, I knew the story was done. Now, I went back and added some chapters after that, you know, based on the conversation I had with my publisher. But the story felt fully vetted and fully rounded. And I felt the closure, and I hope readers feel the closure for this character. I felt like he felt the closure, obviously, in this character. And so I knew it was done when I wrote the end. I did leave an opening for Darius and Megan, but I, you know, a reader said to me, I'm so glad she didn't just, I'm giving away too much of the plot. Okay. I'm so glad she didn't just stay and fall in love. I'm going like, she wasn't that kind of person, you know, she might be in love, but she was such a serious journalist that she would continue her work. I gave away that, didn't I?
No. I think you did just fine. Okay. And Cheryl, thank you for writing such a great book. I enjoyed reading it. I think the readers will pull a lot, especially if you like crime fiction, which I do, and you like historical sides, which I do. So you're pulling from all the different angles, but you make it in a very cohesive and do it in a very cohesive and seamless way. So congratulations on such a great book.
I love that you got it.
Cheryl Head is the author of Time's Undoing. You can find out more about Cheryl at cherylhead.com and on Facebook at cheryl.head.104 and on Twitter at CHEADDC. Thank you, Cheryl, for being a guest on Diverse Voices Book Review.
Amanda, thank you so much for what you do and for what Hope and what you two do. It's really gratifying.
Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.